Welcome to Everything Went Black podcast, episode number 18. This afternoon, I had comic book creator Josh Bear over. We talked about Suspect Device, a series he's been working on for the last couple of years. In addition to being busy with his comics, Josh is also an art teacher over at Third Ward in Brooklyn. If you're interested in getting more information about Josh and buying some of his graphic novels, you can go to www.joshbayer.com. And that's Bayer, like Slayer, except with a B. At the tail end of the talk, Josh refers to an interview that he's doing with me that's going to be coming out in Comics with Dopes. I'll post a link to that once that thing goes live so you guys can all check it out. You know, being a longtime comic book fan, pretty much my whole life I've been reading comics. It was really cool that he asked me to be part of that. So it was, he asked me some really cool questions about you know, books I read, comics I read when I was a kid. So it was a lot of fun. And now here we go. The evening, or afternoon rather, with Josh Bear.
Yeah, I was working on a music video as a production assistant, and I wanted to talk to him the whole time about producing The Laughing Hyenas. And so I just was talking to him, you know, I was like, you know, I just want, you know, tell you how much I love those albums. And he was like, oh yeah. And he was rapping me a little bit about producing them. And then somebody was following him around because of the music video with the camera to record, document it. When the camera got onto him, he got super opportunistic and just like started talking at me, like in a real, like raised his voice and was like, and I just want to say working with those guys was almost every bitch as proud of that as I was to work with Nirvana. Just funny how people are when you put a mic in their mouth.
Yeah, definitely, man. Yeah. I gotta say, I probably like the Laughing Hyenas records better than the Nirvana records.
Well, no doubt.
I was never a big Nirvana fan, really.
Did you ever see them live, Hyenas?
I saw the Hyenas live once. I was supposed to go see them a second time, but they never showed up. It was when I was living in Boston.
Wow.
Yeah, there was like, those guys have a kind of a checkered past with substance abuse and whatnot.
Well,
and,
of course, but I always thought that they, I saw a lot of them come close a lot of times to missing gigs, but yeah. I never saw them actually. I saw them like come in at the last minute. I saw John Brannon perform once, and he had had an overdose earlier in the day, and he's such a pure performer. Mm-hmm. He like got on, and not only did he do it, he did it like it was the best performance I've ever seen him do.
Really?
But, yeah, you'd never know that he would have been on the verge of death that day.
I saw Easy Action down in Texas at South by Southwest one of the years we played, and that was amazing. That was like the best. Oh, that was probably one of my favorite bands. Even though I've seen the Hyenas at one time,
mm-hmm.
but the Easy Action performance was like fucking amazing, man.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And then I saw Negative Approach recently at that. There was that festival, that Power of the Riff festival, where they played and Pentagram played. I gotta say, I was a little underwhelmed by
Pentagram.
Pentagram was amazing, dude. Mm. They were like everything I hoped they would be. But Negative Approach let me down. And I had high hopes because of how good Easy Action was.
Yeah.
You know? But the show they missed, and it was when I was living in Boston. I saw them probably, there was one time I saw them play, and it was like maybe 8 months later. They were supposed to be playing with a band called La Gratona, who, I don't know if you've mm-hmm. heard of them. La Gratona was like a band that was like way ahead of the curve back in 95 or 90, maybe 94, 95, Boston. They were like that sort of gray area between when Rorschach broke up and bands like Dead Guy and Kiss It Goodbye started playing around. And they were sort of very, very much in that like aggressive, like, metal, hardcore, Black Flag, Voivod, you know, sort of trip. Mm-hmm. And I thought they were brilliant. And I saw like almost every show they played, you know, when I was aware of their existence. And in my head, they should have been the biggest band in the world. But like there was never more than like, you know, 30 people there to see them. And I remember thinking how perfect it was when Laughing Hyenas and them, you know, La Gratona were going to play together. And I showed up. And then they were just like, oh yeah, man, Laughing Hyenas didn't make it.
This fucking sucks. Yeah. They're my favorite band growing up for sure. It's the only thing, It was the only thing that validated living in the Midwest was that it was easy. It was easier to see them than it would have been in a bigger city. I lived in Ohio. They were in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Are you from that part of the country?
Yeah, well, kind of. I grew up there. Yeah, but my family always had East Coast roots because my relatives lived. I was born in Buffalo, and then my dad transferred to Ohio for work. And then apparently, if my mom had lived, she died when I was four. She probably would have pushed my dad to leave Ohio. It's kind of a dead end place. And but I'm a lot like him. It takes a lot to push me to do something, and I can get. It would have been pretty easy in my life to get pretty lethargic, or you know, not make major life changes.
Right.
So he was that way, and he stayed in Ohio for a long time. So I didn't move out till I was 24.
Wow. And where did you move to?
L.A.
Oh yeah, that's right. And you're out in L.A. for a while.
11 years. So. Yeah. I saw right before the Hyenas broke up, I saw them play in L.A., and that was when John did that show where he almost died, and they were incredible. They were, like, the closest, in a weird way, they were the closest. John Branham was the closest thing that I think I encountered as an adult to being, like, a superhero. Even though there's punk rock stars who are more superheroic, Rollins definitely comes to mind. I really wanted to be like that dude. I wanted to be like him, like Clinton wanted to be like Elvis.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely Brandon's like one of the guys that like you know, is very distinctive, you know. But I really wanted to that negative approach thing, man. Like,
yeah.
You know, maybe it was the mix. I mean, we got there like right when they were starting to play, and you know, it was just like it just was unsatisfying, you know.
It could be so many things. He could be, I think he loves performing, but you know, he's been forced to go back to doing negative approach. When I saw him with Hyenas, he wanted to evolve as an artist. You know, that sounds could sound like loaded. I mean, he would say on stage stuff like, you know, anybody have any requests? You know, yeah, we're going to bust out the negative approach material real soon. You guys just keep waiting, you know?
You see, that's an interesting thing you bring up, because I feel like a lot of bands, you know, artists and people that play music, whatever, there's like this sort of nostalgic like trip that's going on where I feel like dudes reach a certain age, you know, and they go back to like this, you know, fucking Amber Lens like past where like they're like revisiting all this like old material where I just think it's like a waste of time, really. I mean, it happens. It's like the last like 5 years, how many reams have there been? It's like, you know, Starting New York Hardcore has been like Bold,
Youth of Today,
fucking Gorilla Biscuits, you know, and then there's bands like that, you know, well, the Cro-Mags. You know,
yeah.
Cro-Mags, I mean, who, depending on how you see it, they're either doing a reunion or they never broke up or there's two different Cro-Mags, you know, and like all that material is like 30 years old at this point, you know what I mean?
It's so well tread.
Yeah, and it's like, I guess my thing is the whole thing of experiencing negative approach, understanding that over the last like 25, 30 years, you know, I think it's been that long, right? Mm-hmm. Since negative approach
broke up originally.
Yeah,
like 84. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, 84.
Yeah, so we're coming on that like 3-decade mark.
Yeah, 28 right? years.
And you know, negative approach were a fucking amazing band, brilliant. You know, like definitely one of the, you know, fucking seminal like hardcore bands.
Blueprint Makers.
Yeah, you know, like so even bands now are coming out. There's bands now that sound like Negative Approach.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, still very, very influential. Laughing Hyenas, stepping in totally, just a step forward, man, like a step in an evolution, you know. And then Easy Action, which is like a great band. And,
yeah.
Like, you can see like the trajectory, and then to be okay. Let's go back 30 years and like do material that we're different people. Like we're not even the same fucking creatures we were when we wrote those songs. And then,
yeah, it's just given into audience demand. I mean, I talked to John about it and he just kind of jokes about it. He's like, you know, I have to tell people I was in another band for really like 7 years, you know, because
yeah.
it's like that with comics too. There were some 90s comics creators who had a lot of a lot, who are really in the spotlight, and somehow things evaporated for them. And some people, like the Hernandez brothers, they weathered that out.
Yeah.
Like, they, I know, I read an interview with them where they were like, yeah, you know, we're not really on the people, when the people make the lists of their favorite creators or the best of the year, we're not on them anymore. Maybe they've just taken us for granted, but they had pushed through it.
And yeah.
They, who else? But there's a lot of people who, yeah, whose careers evaporated. But, fuck, I was going to say about the hyenas. Oh, but yeah, you know, with musicians, I saw Joan Jett last year, which is probably one of the 20 top shows I've ever seen.
Was it last summer at Coney Island?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was at that with Jacqueline, actually.
Oh, fuck, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I went to that show, yeah.
I texted her. I thought it was great, and I felt like the mega hits were the things which all the emotion had been sort of just wrung out of, and they were dry. And the songs which are a little bit less known, but she were the ones she had real affection for.
Yeah, I could agree with that, definitely. I could see that, you know.
And you see it all the time. I remember seeing Agnostic Front play, and it was a pretty good show. It was 97, so it was when probably the best as they've been.
Yeah, that was like that when they first got back together again, and it was like Stigma, some dude on bass, a drummer, and Roger, but they didn't have two, they only had one guitarist.
And they did that song, Something's Gotta Give.
Yeah.
And it was just so fucking emotional. And it wasn't like a song, like, you know, that he had done a zillion times. He was like, you know, you could see him rocking back on his, you know, just fucking completely, like, rocked back on his heels singing it. And it actually reminded me a lot of the Hyenas, just like this complete emotional catharsis.
Dude, if you like the Hyenas, then you should definitely check out that band Lagertona.
Okay.
It'll make you, like, you know, some sort of discography of their material, because there's a lot of elements of what I like about the Hyenas in that band, but coupled with, you know, crazy Voivod influence guitar playing, like a really heavy, like Black Flag like feel too.
Cool, can't wait.
Yeah, that's a band not too many people know about outside of Boston. I mean, you know, there's like a small circle of friends that I know that, you know about them and recognize them as a great band. And, you know, a discography came out a few years ago on Tortuga Records, which is like, you know, kind of like a Hydra Head sort of, you know, there's a connection with Tortuga and Hydra Head. And it came out, and like, that was, you know, came and went, man. Like, even with like a fairly well-known small label behind it who put out material by Old Man Gloom, who a band, you know, that's like a ISIS, you know, Converge kind of, you know, hybrid band.
Like members of those bands?
Yeah, it's Aaron Turner from ISIS and, you know, a zillion other things you can say about that dude that he's been involved with that's notable. You know, and this guy Santos and Nate Newman from Jesuit. And, yeah, it's like a, you know, Old Man Gloom's like a really well-known band. And the label that put out the Lagertona record discography, and I actually wrote liner notes for the discography, and it was just came and went, man. You know, it was like this little blip, and then everyone who knew about them, you know, picked it up, but no one really seemed to get on board with it, and it was just kind of a drag because I've got nothing but like heavy respect for those guys. Mm-hmm. You know, they influenced me, man. I saw them play, and I was just like, wow, I want to do a band similar to this, you know, and that's what almost motivated me to do something more, you know, chaotic when I started doing the band Anodyne. It was actually with one of the members from that band.
No shit.
Yeah, the drummer, Taz Niles, who used to play in Eye for an Eye, the Boston hardcore band Eye for an Eye.
What label were they on?
Tang.
Fuck me, I knew that name, but I don't remember them.
Yeah, they're like, you know, I'm going to say maybe similar to Burn in some ways, you know. But, you know, Taz was definitely influenced by Black Flag and like the Amphetamine Reptile, you know, catalog, and Lagertona was like definitely doing exactly the kind of thing that I would like to have done at the time, and that's what motivated me when the band that I was in at the time I saw them play broke up. I was like, yeah, man, I want to do something like a little bit more crazy, you know. And Taz and I linked up because we had a lot of mutual friends, and they were just like, you two guys should know each other. just straight up, like my friend Chris, he was just like, you two guys definitely should know each other because you're into the same shit. Mm-hmm. And if you ever play together, it would be a good thing. And that was kind of how it was put. And then back then, that was before email and texting, so I had a phone number. And he gave me Taz's number, and I called him, and we just started playing together. And then, you know, this band happened. You know, he wasn't in the band the whole time. It was only in the very beginning. I believe, Taz is only on the demo, and he played maybe, you know, a handful of shows with us. But he kicked off the whole thing with me, and it was really cool. And it was all basically from me watching La Gritona play and then thinking, like, wow, I love Black Flag, I love The Birthday Party, I love Laughing Hyenas and Voivod and all that stuff. And, you know, I'd really like to do something as intense as this. You know? Mm-hmm. And I kind of, like, you know, launched me into that whole thing, you know. But, I met you when you worked at Cosmic Comics.
Yeah.
That's how we know each other, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it seems like we've known each other for a while now.
Is that like 5 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe four. Jacqueline came in there maybe 2009, so maybe 2008. About 4 years.
Yeah. And had you been working there long? Like, was that like...
Yeah, it started in 2007. And the place had a really good influence on me. I mean, Mark Friedman, who owned Cosmic on 23rd Street, he was a great guy to talk to about art. And he ran the place in such a loose grip. You know, he let me do goofy drawings and put them around, but the drawings were a big that was a big testing ground for what people liked. Like, I would do these big drawings with a marker and paste them up around the store. Like, I remember, the only one I really remember is I did one of Iron Fist, and he was saying something like, you know, okay, you guys have burned me a cigarette, shoved amphetamines in my nose, you know, done lines off my back, but now it's my turn. And it was like a big, thick drawing. He let me hang that up. Like, it didn't matter what the content was. He's such a fucking hip old guy.
Yeah, totally.
And but it was also the line. I discovered, you know, I'm used to doing comics, and you've got to cram information into a grid, and your line gets really thin. So all of a sudden, it'll be like this release. I could step back from the stuff, and I could say, well, look at that. If I rip like a big marker and do a big thick line, I could get immediate gratification. People want to look at it. So then he let me do the dry erase boards on the outside, and it was the same thing pretty much. I'd have like a big, fat version of Batman that was kind of influenced by the way Daniel Johnston would draw Captain America or Casper, where he'd just keep on doing this kind of fun, round line as if everybody was kind of like the Michelin Man, an arm was kind of big, this big, weird, arbitrarily delineated shape. And I started doing that, and that's just fucking a fun way to draw. You don't have to give a shit about real anatomy, and you can get in, then you can start doing a big wide mouth like the way E.C. Segar would do Popeye. And so I'd do like a big picture of whatever came to my head. Spider, big fat ass Spider-Man, his body, you know. And there's something fun about making a big square shape or a big squarish round shape. Like one artist I read an interview with, he said that Jason Little, he said that the reason cartoonists like drawing big asses isn't necessarily just about an ass fetish. Something's curvy. It's like a big fun line to draw. So that was really cool. And I started, like, it started being a, I can't think of the right word, but it was sort of like a, I could see people genuinely, like, they'd come up all excited and be like, I like that drawing.
Yeah.
So it influenced me a lot. And it gave me, at the time, my comics were nowhere. Before I started working there, I did two comics that, I spent like $2,000 doing a big print run of, and I ate the whole print run basically. And it was kind of like I didn't know what I was going to do next, and I was really scared about printing again. It was just like it kind of kept me a little bit straitjacketed, that experience.
Yeah.
And so anyways, while I was there, that was like a really good for my art, actually. It was like another semester of school for me.
Also, Cosmic, like the location of that shop and the clientele sort of lent itself to that kind of experimentation in some ways, right? I mean, it wasn't like, you know,
it's not like working in Midtown or something.
Yeah, this is New York City, like Flatiron area, you know, that neighborhood is primarily, I mean, you work there, but I used to go there, but I remember it being more just like, you know, adults, you know, not very many kids rolling through there.
Mm-mm. And that's true, yeah.
Mainly like dudes who work in that area or kids who go to, SVA?
Yeah.
You know, that was pretty much the cross-section of people that went there.
Yeah.
So like, you know, the sort of clients that went there, the people, the customer base were probably a little bit more open to like more adult-themed material.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, you know, people responding to your artwork and whatnot, you know, this sort of, you know, avant-garde approach to like some of their favorite superheroes and whatnot, you know, like, the kind of references and whatever.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I could have probably clamped down some of the content and still got the style across. There was more kids there, but yeah, it's totally true. And there was a lot of, who do we have? We had John Spencer from John Spencer Blues Explosion. He was a customer there. I'm trying to think who else. There's a lot of people.
The guy from fucking
Cars.
Yeah,
Ricker Casey.
Yeah, Jacqueline told me Ricker Casey just to stroll through there every now and then.
Oh, did she tell you? You probably know all about this, but he came through and I asked him about producing the Chromatics. Did Jacqueline tell you this story?
No, I don't even. Don't.
I mean, I'm sorry, shit, the Bad Brains. I mean, Bad Brains.
No. Okay, so Rick Ocasek rolls into Cosmic.
Rick Ocasek rolls in, and we're talking to him, and he's super approachable. Whereas most rock stars or, you know, people, you know, ex-rock stars or whatever he is, I guess once you're a rock star, you're a rock star. It's almost like the pro wrestling attitude where if you are, if they identify you as a fan, they identify you as a mark.
Oh, yeah, I see, yeah.
Yeah, but he wasn't like that. He was super cool and really friendly and looked exactly the same as in the old days, just with more lines on his face. So just kind of more, he just got more intense as he got older. So I asked him about producing Bad Brains, and he said, and Jacqueline was like, don't you carry around some kind of, like, deed that... HR gave you, and he pulls out this thing out of his wallet, and it's a handmade check that HR had made him, and it says, this grants Rick Ocasek a piece of heaven, and it's like signed by HR's name, and then it's by like from HR and like some 15 word, you know, organization, like the holy transcendental afterlife organization of, you know, of a beloved Jah or something. And wow. he carried around with him since 82 when he produced
Quickness.
I thought it was Rock for Light.
Oh yeah, wait, Rock. Yeah.
It could have done two albums too.
I'm like, yeah, it was definitely Rock for Light. I'm not sure if we did Quickness.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's nuts, man. Also, the actual location for Cosmic Comics, wasn't that the KISS, like, practice space or something?
Yeah. Let's talk shit about KISS. You and me have never seen eye to eye with KISS.
Wait, hold on a Mania. I hate KISS.
Well, okay, I feel like down deep I must not hate them because I love the Melvins version of Blind and I love the Replacements version of Black Diamond.
Black Diamond, yeah.
And there's one other cover, I think, that I didn't know was them until recently. And I genuinely love these songs, you know? Not KISS's version, though.
I hate the band, everything about them. And I know that's, like, really unpopular with people. But I like one song. I like that song, Parasite, that's on, like, Hotter Than Hell.
Mm.
And that was during a phase when I was like, yeah, man, I want to, like, check KISS out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And
I tried to.
I just, their whole thing, man. Like, their whole trip just seems weak, you know?
Oh, God. Seeing who's the dragon guy? Gene being interviewed on the Henry Rollins show was maybe the absolute lowest point of culture. forming it, because he has to sit, because Gene's staying there and he's establishing all this shit, like, you know, if you're in the record business, you're in the Kiss business, you know, if you're on stage, you're there to sell t-shirts just as much as I am, so you're in the Kiss business, I'm in the Kiss business. It's just like, Rollins just sitting there nodding, you know, kind of like, it was like seeing him being held captive by this guy's authority. It fucking sucked.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when we were in Richmond recording Winter Hours, I was staying at Dave Witte's place. You know, usually, like, when we go out of town to record, the band is there for a few days. They finish up the drums and the bass, and then I'm there for, like, you know, a week by myself doing vocals, guitars, and mixing and everything. So my friend Dave Witte, he plays in, you know, like, Human Remains, Burnt by the Sun. He's in Municipal Waste now, and, like, all these bands. You know, I'm staying with him. And, you know, I get back from the studio at, like, 1 o'clock in the morning, and the Kiss, Gene Simmons' reality show is on. Like,
oh, yeah, it's another reason I hate him.
It was, like, this marathon of Gene Simmons and his, like, horrible, like, life and those two women with the, you know, implanted lips and everything.
Like, you can't tell which one's his daughter, which one's his wife.
I think one's, like, I don't even think either one of her is his wife. I think one's, like, his, you know, fucking lady that bears his children, and the other one is, like, some other hanger-on or whatever. But, yeah, just, like, watching him, like, him relating to the rest of the world, and, like, that made me just, like, just be disgusted by that, dude, you know?
That was the other thing on the show I forgot about. He was so proud of the fact, he was like, look, on my reality show, I let it all, I'm so real, I let it all fucking hang out. I've had my facial surgery recorded where I guess they took his face off and fucking flipped it back, like, so you could see his skull, and they showed it on the air.
That's heavy, man.
It is heavy, and he was really proud of that. And he was proud of it because it made him more... he's just like, look how fucking accessible I'm being on my show. You know, in another context, maybe that would be... First of all, it's the context of him glamorizing himself. It's just complete shit from beginning to end. Second of all, it's for his fucking please get on my knees, please pay attention to me reality show. It's just the two things, just they're not cool.
No, not at all. You know, and musically, I think it's fucking their garbage Kiss. You know what I mean? It's like... Yeah, I don't know, man. I remember back in the 90s or something, like when the Melvins got, you know, started getting, you know, fairly successful. Mm-hmm. You know, the Melvins are huge Kiss fans.
Yeah.
And suddenly you would be walking past groups of people and you would overhear conversations about how Kiss was, like, you know, this influential band, and, like, Kiss was, like, you know, good. You'd hear glimpses of conversations. Oh, yeah, you know, Kiss, you know, Destroyer. And it's just like... Like, naming a record Destroyer is fucking awesome. Yeah. That's cool. Like, I would love to own a record called Destroyer and have that record be great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that record sucks. That record's fucking garbage. And, like...
You ever heard Twisted Sister's song, Destroyer?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great song.
Well, Twisted Sister, you can't fuck with Twisted Sister. I love that band.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would love for Kiss to have been as cool as Twisted Sister, but they just weren't. And that also fanned the flames for my, you know, hatred for Kiss. And then there would be... all the myriads of Kiss tribute bands that popped up in the 90s. And, you know, people would go, and it would be like this weird borderline irony. But, you know, it would be ironic to a certain extent. But then it was like that irony turned into actually the second wave of people actually being into the music.
I'll tell you, drawing Gene Simmons in Kiss makeup is really easy, though.
Yeah.
And I would, so don't, you know, anybody sees my comics and sees that I've, like, fucking had somebody walk on stage and they're dressed in Gene Simmons makeup. These two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, because it's easy and everybody recognizes it, and there is a sort of a cultural touchstone. Not that I've done it, but I would. And Nick Cave is actually really easy to draw, too. Both of them, from a distance, he's just a big mustache and receding hairline and the huge eyebrows.
Yeah, yeah. So, you also teach at Third Ward, right?
Third Ward, Educational Alliance, 92nd Street Y, and sometimes some other places, yeah.
It's all, like, art-related stuff you're doing?
Oh, yeah, it's all art. It's 90% of it's comic books.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Majority of my classes are how to do comics.
Like, typically, what would, like, you know, what would you be teaching in your classes? Like, and what kind of stuff?
The first class, I do a little lecture, which sounds like it would be esoteric, but it's not, about panel transitions. And I say, you know, it's just like the same way in a film class, you learn about editing the scenes. So I go into the very first class, just to pick an arbitrary point to start, I talk about Scott McCloud's 7 basic transitions, but I think I have it pared down to 6. And it's just a technical thing, and I warn them. I'm like, this isn't going to be like a lecture class. These are actually really useful ideas. Because Scott McCloud has it down to, he was the first person to identify the transitions between panels. So, and he talked about how there's a lot of information which happens outside of a panel.
Yeah.
So, like, I always talk to my students about how, like, there's an old panel of Little Orphan Annie, and she's, like, getting hustled off of her corner where she's trying to sell donuts by a cop. Cop's like, get out of here, you don't have a license. And she's like, hey, don't tell me to get out of here before you try one of my donuts. And she's like reaching out to him, and in the next panel he has a half-eaten donut, and he's like, okay, these are pretty good donuts, but you still got to get out. And I'm like, look at how you don't see him eating the donut.
Right.
We jumped forward. So I talked them about, they got to think, you know, I get them aware of those kind of, how they don't have to be handcuffed to showing every little thing.
Oh, so it's like a certain economy of storytelling where there's like certain things that are not necessarily more implied than like actually illustrated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they talk about all the different transitions, different countries, how they, you know, all that stuff is cool. So anyways, that leads them into the first assignment. And then then I also teach them inking, then using a lot of the techniques I was taught at SBA, like to have to get used to the materials. And then I give them like, I try to jumpstart the process by getting them to do stuff like that's built upon old comics. So like anybody who knows my book Suspect Device, which I edit, which is like you're basically you're collaging old panels into new comics. So I'll give them 2 unrelated panels, just like I do with my friends who I invite to Suspect Device, and I'll have them improvise new comics. And that makes it a lot, it totally tricks them into doing comics. And it also takes care of the design. You know, if I have like an old man, if Nancy from Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy is talking to an old bum on a bench, you have the design of the bum, you got the tree, you have the bench, you know, and then they can take it in whatever direction they want, you know. And I usually get super cool responses from that. Then I do another assignment where I give them an old Popeye comic. It's I call the Popeye Meets Demon assignment. I give them Popeye, and like Popeye and Wimpy are trapped inside of a well, and then I give them a bunch of like Hieronymus Bosch looking demons, like crazy demons where there's like, you know, he'll have like a face in his elbow,
yeah,
and 2 dog heads and his titties, and like a weird monster face in his pelvis eating a baby. And I'll give them a bunch of different demons, and I'll say, you can do whatever you want with this comic, but you gotta have Popeye and Wimpy meet this demon. And you end up, and I encourage them, like, don't go for easy laughs necessarily. Don't worry about the punchline or about this even, you know, reaching like a funny conclusion, because it'll be funny anyways. And you get a lot of, my stuff tends to be, you know, you get a lot of like Henry Darger-ish looking comics, which are just weird and kind of non sequiturs. And then I start pushing forward and getting people to do more stuff where they're just pulling the comics out from inside of them, and they're less dependent on those triggers.
Yeah.
But if they continue just doing triggers forever, that's what I do these days. I mean, if I get invited to an anthology, I'll just take a random panel and I'll just stare at it until I think of a funny comic or an interesting comic, and it's loosened me up a lot. So
the Suspect Device, like that, what is that exactly? I mean, that's like something you're working on, like, you know, just go into like, you know, like maybe there aren't, probably aren't people who are familiar with that.
Suspect Device is a comic that I do where I based it on an exercise from the class, and it's like, if I invite you to the comic, I'll mail you a bunch of random comic frames that I've cut out, ones that are interesting. And the idea is like that you take 2 frames that don't belong together, and you string together a story between them to have them make sense. So the first one is Nancy talking to a bum, and in the last one it's like Dick Tracy putting like a thief in jail, and you somehow make these things add up, you know. So maybe the bum is part of some kind of underground army of street, you know, homeless thieves like Fagin, you know. So whatever, wherever your brain tends to go. And I pass them out, and it's been really, really good for it's been really good for me. It's been like, that book has grown and grown and grown. The first issue was 35 pages. The second issue was 120 pages. I got to meet a lot of cartoonists from doing it. I've gotten, it's put me on equal footing or closer to equal footing with a lot of people who I really looked up to. So the people in the next book, I mean, it's nuts. Except for two people, everybody that I've asked to be in it from the independent comic scene has agreed to be in it. The next issue is going to have Zach Sally, Johnny Ryan, Jesse Jacobs, who did this new book, By This You Will Know Him. Ask Laura Park from Chicago to be in it. She invited all of Trouble Club. So anyways, a lot of fucking really good people. And what else? Oh, and the name... You know, the name Suspect Device is from the Stiff Little Finger song, but it's also, the stress is on the word device, because every page is dependent on this device, you know. And it's also suspect, because there's always a possibility that this whole thing could blow apart on me. I had kind of slipping underneath the radar right now. You know, there's a little bit of a gray area when it comes to reproducing photocopy comics.
Oh, yeah, right. Yep. Some sort of like, you know, intellectual property or something like that.
Yeah, it's a suspect.
So it's like, are you familiar with like Brian Geisen and like, you know, Throbbing Gristle?
Yeah.
And it's similar, like this sort of cut up, you know, construction trip that those guys used to do back
in the day. No, I didn't pay that much attention to the music.
Oh, yeah. Well, not so much Throbbing Gristle, but there's like Brian, I think, oh, damn, so Brian Geisen or Burroughs.
Sure.
They had this thing of like, cutting up stories and reconstructing them.
Well, I was talking to Mike McGonigal, and he was saying, you know, he's like, you're on such solid footing. He goes, there's pieces of art which are in the Metropolitan Museum or the LA County Art Museum, which are historically important, and every single stitch of art on the canvas is reappropriated. There's right. arts which are all entirely... There's that famous pop art piece, what is it that makes today's world so different and astounding, which has like Charles Atlas holding a lollipop stand on top of a Pollock. There's actually a Jack Kirby comic like on the wall. And every single element in that comic is reappropriated from a magazine. But actually, it's a funny story. It shows the double standard with comics. I was in an art history class in LA at Columbia. I can't remember what fucking university it was. UCLA night classes, and the teacher knew everything about everything that was pictured in that that image. She knew everything. She was like, "This is." The garment manufacturing industry was at, you know, this point when this is done, and the drapes are reflective of this breakthrough in interior decorating, and the rug is of course the Jackson Pollock, and blah de blah blah. And then she goes, and there's a comic book on the wall, and I was like, that's, and I raised my hand, and I'm like, you know, you might want to at least give Jack Kirby the dignity of acknowledging who he was. And she had no, she was in her 70s.
She had no idea who Jack Kirby was?
She had no idea what I was talking about. She basically was like, what? And I go, you know, because I was interrupting her class. I go, well, it's Jack Kirby. He, you know, it's kind of significant that he invented him and Joe Simon invented the whole genre of the love romance comic, which is what's represented on the wall. He invented the romance comic. He invented... Now I'm drawing a blank. He invented, like, him. They invented a few genres.
Oh, well, you know, Jack Kirby's involvement with Stan Lee, too, you know, in the 60s. Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, all the significant comic book characters from Marvel Comics, really.
But for sure.
Creations, yeah.
For sure. Those were, you know, wasn't Zach. I mean, he helped blueprint the genre of the superhero comic, too. And, yeah, and she was just like, it was like I was speaking a different language, but that always stuck out in my head as the... kind of weird.
The division between like low art and high art and how comic books are still considered, or, you know, entertainment as opposed to art.
Yeah.
it's kind of like punk rock too, you know, like punk and, I mean, maybe not so much these days, but the battle between like punk rock being considered, you know, serious work or whatever, you know, something that's that you can put in the same, you know, sentence as like you know, other types of music which are given like jazz or like,
right,
blues or something like that.
Right.
You know, as like we got further away from the 80s, I remember looking back on, you know, the punk records that came out in the 80s and thinking like, yeah, this is like you know, the late 20th century blues music, you know, like where, you know, rhythm, like American rhythm and blues,
mm-hmm,
you know, Robert Johnson and, you know, all those guys, very austere, lo-fi, like emotionally, mm-hmm, charged medium, you know, created under very, you know, low budget circumstances,
yeah, yeah,
you know, how that became like, you know, this sort of influential genre. And that's, you know, I remember all through the 90s thinking about like, you know, like Circle Jerks and Black Flag and like Dead Kennedys and the Germs and, you know, all those bands, about how that's like, you know, like the suburban white guy.
I think John, everybody credits John Brannan's the quote, it's the blues of the suburbs.
Yeah, actually, I think, yeah, actually, it comes to mind. Yeah.
And how cool is it that now in New York, with, you know, you start to see black guys with and women in with, like, punk t-shirts? I'm not sure. I always want to ask them, like, if, you know, how far their interest in it goes.
Yeah, that's, these days, it's like a real, you know, uncertain marker as to like whether or not someone knows what the fuck they're representing with their clothing or their shirts, mm-hmm, or anything. Carson, our old, you know, Tunes' old bass player, he's telling me a story about he and his wife went to he's like a big restaurant dude, and he loves going out to eat. He knows about all these different types of food, and so he's big on going out to these nice restaurants or whatever. So he went to some place in the city, and the Major D had a Charles Bronson t-shirt on,
mm-hmm,
you know, the band Charles Bronson, mm-hmm, the punk rock band. And you know, Carson says to the guy, he's like, "Hey man, are you you know, you're a fan of Charles Bronson fan? You know, do you like hardcore music?" And the guy's like, "What?
Death Wish?
What are you talking about?" He's like, "Charles Bronson, it's a band." He's like, "It's not a band. Like, I like Charles Bronson the actor. You know, I saw this shirt at like, you know, fucking whatever that closet." What's that fucking broad's closet fucking place?
The Beacon's Closet?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, yeah. All those chicks go to buy their clothes. And he's like, "Oh, I got it inside Beacon's Closet. And it's a, you know, I like Charles Bronson, you know, Death Wish and whatever." And like, people have no fucking idea, man. So like, part of me is like, yeah, it's cool. But like, on the other hand, I'm like, maybe you're not getting the point. Maybe you don't understand like what this music means to people, or what, you know, maybe it's just a surface, yeah, kind of.
Maybe thing. Surface.
That's not to say that there aren't African Americans out there that love punk music and are very much influenced by it and into it, you know.
But yeah, I mean, I'm from a fucking Ohio. I have my own, like, kind of, like, bludgeoning way of, like, approaching race, you know? It's like, but, you know, it's like, yeah, it's sort of a really broad statement I made. But, yeah, I live in Harlem, and I see, especially the last couple years, I saw a lot of Mohawks. I saw in my building, which is, like, you know, there's a lot of lower income families, and I'd see people wearing like Dead Kennedys and Bad Brains t-shirts, and other white bands too, like Leonard Skinner, which could just be ironic, you know. But and it seems to be, all I can say is it makes complete sense to me, because maybe the only cool thing the white people have ever produced culturally is punk rock. So, seeing, and white kids have been ripping off hip hop for so fucking long, it would be such a nice payback.
Yeah.
So, I did, before I moved out of Bed-Stuy, I did see a lot of little signifiers, you know, of like a cultural mix happening. You'd see kids from the projects wearing like studded belts and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that whole style is kind of like, you know, definitely like crossed over into like other things here, you know, these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But so when you were in LA, were you going to school? Were you going to art school in LA?
No, I was working. I lived in Ohio, and I dropped out of art school when I was 19. I was paying for it myself. I had like a good scholarship, but then it dried up after my first year. And my grandfather had died in a car wreck and left me like $20,000. So I had, that would have fucking pissed away all that money in a couple years. So I just basically tried to save it, and I like lived in this apartment without a phone and just got little jobs when I could, and kind of like I lived on off a high street on 2nd Avenue in Columbus. And anyways, my prospects really dried up, and my brother Sam was super like big, he's in that big brother concern mode, and he was like, what, you know, you got to start thinking about what you're going to do with your life. So he invited me out to, once he got successful, my brother's a really successful video director and commercial and film director, and he invited me out to live with him in L.A. So I came out when I was 24, and I just, you know, I was basically unemployable when I came out. Didn't have any job skills, didn't know how to present myself. So I had a hard time finding a place in the job market, so... You know, after a while, I figured out, like, I figured out a couple things I could do. I worked at the New Art Movie Theater for a long time and in L.A., and I got a, I worked on a lot of my brother's sets. And I got into the Electricians Union, but thinking the more I did that, I'd eventually get good at it. Yeah. But I sucked. I couldn't figure out. My brain just doesn't work that way. So I did grip work and electrical work, and I was really fucking dumb about that stuff. I couldn't memorize the equipment. I mean, I got some stuff I made progress with, but it wasn't like, it wasn't a good fit. When I started teaching, that's the first job that I did where you get all these signs that this is what you're meant to do. So, I mean, just, you know, feedback from people and just the way you kind of figured out for yourself. So, was I going to school? No, I went to a lot of shows. I was really into punk, though. I would drive an hour and a half out of my way to see shows back then. I remember seeing Integrity and Corona, and that's, I also saw Agnostic Front.
Corona is what's the name of that venue out there? That's I had it on the tip of my tongue, man.
It's like three syllables, right?
Yeah. So. My the guy who books tunes actually used to run that place.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Corona.
And you get to the Bell House, the Glass House in like Pomona that. A lot, okay. Too.
Yeah.
Pomona and Corona, because I wanted to avoid the L.A. scene where it just seemed like everybody, the more, the bigger the show, the more people came out, the more loud and obvious the people wanted to be. I liked quiet shows, you know. Being in Ohio, I grew up like watching a lot of shows that would be like 50 people in the place.
Yeah.
Still kind of fucks it up for me when I see too many people at a show.
Yeah. The what years were that when you were out? Was it the early 90s? You were talking about Integrity.
94 until 2005. The very beginning of 2005.
Oh, wow. So you're out there for a while.
11 years, yeah.
Do you, do you miss L.A. at all?
No, but if I did, I visited a few times, and I definitely have a different feeling about it now. I mean, it was kind of like, I went out there, I was living like in, right next to Venice, it was culturally the West Side is really different. I never went to what's it called? The Silver Lake area, Eagle Rock, and can't think of the other town, but I spent a lot of time out there the last time I visited, and that part of town is really cool. So if I went back, that's more like the Eagle Rock area and Silver Lake, and I can't think of the other
Wendell.
No, that's too far out, but it's a lot more like New York. It's a lot more like small businesses, and so yeah, I don't miss it that much though. I like New York a lot.
Now, as a comic book creator, you have what other work do you have out besides the pieces that we were talking about? So you mentioned the your first self-published $2,000, what was that? Like what was the name of that?
I did two, so I was adding them together. I did one that was like a comic I did at SBA that was about Bob Dylan's conversion to Christianity called The Fighter, and that came out in 2007, and then I followed it up with a story that was like a 60-page comic, which was about, it was sort of like a, it's called Bike Rider, and it was supposed to be kind of like a version of Taxi Driver, where it was like a punk guy who like rides a bike everywhere, and instead of having Harvey Keitel as the pimp, I had that Dub Cheney guy from American Apparel, like a thinly veiled version of him. And the guy falls, instead of falling in love with Jodie Foster, he falls in love with this woman he sees on the street, and then he realizes that she's like going to be, she's basically going to Dub Cheney's house to get photographed from her, by her, and he get photographed by him, and he goes up like, you know, acting like he's a dude who's delivering their food, and he just comes into the bike chain and just beats him to the ground. That's the whole comic. And you know, The Fighter was received really well in small doses. I mean, it was more feedback than I'd ever gotten before. Tom Hart, who is probably the best friend my career's ever had, and a really good mentor that I had at school of visual arts. Tom Hart's like, I always say that he's like the Velvet Underground. Like, everybody who comes into contact with him goes on, spins off doing like their own comic eventually. And he's had he's been like this, formed this conduit of a cartoonist, and he's been a huge, huge influence on me. So he put the comic in the hands of a lot of people, that you know, responded to it well. So I sold like 40 copies through pushing it at MoCA in 2006 or 7, and that was more success than I'd ever had before. Aside from selling some paintings in LA, that was always like hit or miss. So I thought that my career was starting to build up, but then the rest of that print run after MoCA, I just kind of ate it. I didn't know how to push it. It was too big. Weird size. I didn't have a decent cover, and I said in another interview that like if you ever like really fail at a project, it leaves this like permanent like wound in you. Like you can like I can go back and like taste the feeling of having eaten that. I had to move and fucking just throw out hundreds of copies of this comic, and it's like wounding. But that doesn't mean that's a bad thing. I mean, it's all about how you're going to react.
Yeah, I can relate to that, man. It's like doing, you know, I did a label for a long time. You know, I started the label pretty much at the tail end of like when people could actually successfully do a label. I still was in the beginning. I was able to sell a lot of material, but then the last few years, it was this sort of rise of downloading and vinyl print, you know, copies. I moved a fair amount of those, and then couple that with bands just breaking up, like. The last one of the last releases I put out was this band Azra, who Andrew, our drummer, used to be in that band, and they were friends, and they were awesome, like death, like grind band, and put out their record, and like within a month of the record being released, they broke up. So I sold a bunch of them, but not nearly enough to recoup. So doing the label, though, was creatively rewarding for me. Was financially, like, you know, fucking
money pit.
Hit, you know what I mean? Yeah. And, it helped me, helped me learn. I learned a lot, but there was definitely, I can relate to, like, you think back to the money you threw out the window, and you're just like, man, it's an unpleasant feeling, but it's not something that ever was an obstacle for me. It never prevented me from trying other things, though.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I think failing at things is always a good thing too. Learning how, like, losing, you know, and failing at first, understanding that feeling is necessary, and to learn how to not be discouraged by that feeling is really the that's the mission is to not be discouraged.
I was listening to this Ice-T audiobook recently, and he said that Ice-T, I think his real name is Tracy Marrow, and he said that he was in the military like in 79. And
really? I had no idea about that.
I know. And he was in the military, and he said that he had this one sergeant whose job was basically to make soldiers feel like shit. And he was mad at them because they wouldn't cut their hair. They'd just take their hair and they'd shove it up in their hats, because otherwise when they went to town, none of the girls would look at them and they wanted to get, you know. So he was like, why won't you? He's like, why won't you guys fucking cut your hair? And he goes up to Mero's, I think that's his name, to Ice-T's face. And he said he could fuck. I picture this guy like Sergeant Rock, because he said he could fucking smell coffee and tobacco on his breath. And the guy's face is 2 inches from him, and he goes, "Mero, I can see right through you. The only reason you're in the military is because you can't hack it in civilian life." And he said it really fucking stuck with him, like left a stain. And he said that there's moments in your life which are turning points where you either. You either go one way or the other. You either like let something like that continue to crush you, or you fucking find a way around it. And I'll add on, maybe identify, you know, maybe embrace whatever's true in what he said.
Yeah.
And so that was me eating those books. Was like, that was the world saying to me, you know, having the same moment with the sergeant that he had, same moment with the world and their reaction to the book. And again, that's why being a cosmic and getting the opposite reaction, seeing people reaching for the comic or getting excited about it, a drawing that I did. So, yeah, I've had those moments again and again. You can't let anything fucking stop you. And if you need to redesign, like, how your business is.
Yeah, totally. You know,
we're both doing all kinds of great shit, including this podcast.
Yeah, you know, and things are up and down, you know, in general. I mean, probably one of the things for me personally, like, it's just training jiu-jitsu. That's one of the without failing, because, you know, like, on a daily basis, you're involved in a life and death fight with another guy, you know, who in the beginning completely dominates you because of your lack of experience in fighting, you know, and grappling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can train all these moves and like learn all these techniques and everything, but then once the moment of truth comes where you're involved in real time combat with somebody, their experience level and their comfort level with confrontation will win out over your inexperience all the time. And you have to become comfortable with, you know, being submitted by someone else, or, you know, getting your guard passed, or getting beaten or dominated by these other dudes in your class.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's guys like who are physically completely unimposing, you know, like
a dude's
130 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ties you in a knot and like strangled you. And then you got to be cool with that. Like, you have to process that. Like, the first time I did a live role with someone, like, I'd been training for months, just working the techniques and drilling. And then the first time I actually did like a sparring, like live full sparring, I just got dominated, you know. And it was afterward, I all these feelings of you know, my feelings were fucking crushed. Like, any self, like, you know, confidence I had might have been destroyed. But then, like, it took me a few days to really understand that whole thing and realize that, like, everyone there had started at the same point I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was up to me to, like, you know, not even really understand how to win, but understand how to lose, to understand about where I was going wrong and build a defense against, like, how not to lose, like, how to prevent myself from being strangled by somebody. And then through that, learning an offense. You know, there's like an interesting piece online that Hiron Gracie has, who's you know, he's part of the Gracie family, which is like, they developed Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, basically. Mm-hmm. And he talks about losing. He talks about, like, becoming an expert at losing and becoming an expert at being submitted, you know, and not letting that get in the way of your Jiu-Jitsu practice, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I was thinking, it's like we were talking earlier about, you know, you were saying before we started the podcast about the psychology, the philosophy of martial arts that has to do with controlling your emotions. Most profound shit. And I was thinking last night, every now and then when I get in a bad mood, and I start thinking about, like, you know, one thing that drives me fucking ape shit is the language online. When people who are hidden and are online will, like, go on YouTube or whatever, and they use that one phrase, owned. This guy got owned.
Yeah.
This guy got owned. And it's like, you know, what was the other phrase that they used? Epic fail. Owen drives me batshit, though. I'm like, you know, do they understand, like, what, you know, do they understand the symbology of what they're talking about? Have you ever fucking gone to prison and had somebody else make you a piece of property? And do you think if you actually understood that inside out, you'd fucking still be like standing back and being, man, that guy got owned. Did you see him? Came into jail, and the next day he fucking got his head fucking cracked open with like a random like brick or a dead weight, and fucking next thing you know, he had fucking 20 dudes going inside him, and then he was fucking emotionally traumatized and fucking lived the rest of his life about a shred of dignity. He got owned. I'm just like, you know, I read an interview with Jim Goad where he talked about how a lot of people who write about violence, they've never really experienced violence.
Yeah, it's all abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they like, you see that a lot. It's different if I like a lot of my work, it'll have like violent imagery in it, and I've had people tell me it always feels like I'm not just kind of laying it out there and being like, look at this, isn't this cool? Or people got impaled and their heads put on spikes. There's usually something self-recriminating about what I'm doing. I'm kind of saying, you know, I'm fucked up and this is fucked up, and it's a two-way thing. So I'm glad that I've gotten that. I've like know what it's like to be, you know, I grew up with like fucking everybody victimizing me. You know, grew up, I was like, I think it's more interesting to read.
Yeah, it's like in general, the online world where, you know, no one has to be accountable for the things they say is like, I think one of the worst byproducts of, you know, sort of free information age, or, you know, this like internet world where we're all have access to each other, but also people are irresponsible with the way that they communicate sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, there's this move away from the physical world, which is interesting to me because, you know, our physiology, we still have all these feelings of, you know, these instincts that are part of our makeup from when we lived in the forest, you know, and we had this way more lifestyle where we would have to like hunt and kill and gather and all this other stuff. But that sort of anxiety that we feel from not using our bodies gets played out in these other ways, you know, and the more and more people spend online and have these sedentary lifestyles, that overall feeling of anxiety and whatnot, like they just reflect that out onto other people that they're communicating with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, yeah, because I gotta be honest with you, man. I don't feel the need to like talk shit about people online. Like I don't feel, if I don't like something, I just don't fucking like it. I don't care. You know, I'm like, huh, I'm not into that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never feel compelled to like fucking write the, you know, this fucking guy suck. You know, that's not where I'm at, man. And I think really what it comes down to is like the amount of physical activity that I engage with on a daily basis helps me manage those feelings, you know? And I think that the sort of abstraction of our existence and our consciousness going out in this more abstract world creates like a lot of anxiety in people, you know? It gives them this sort of freewheeling access to like take snipes at other people, you know?
Yeah.
Like nasty text messages and, you know, forums where they just rip people apart, and like YouTube comments and Facebook shit and all that other stuff.
It's crazy. It's like people will just shit on each other. They'll shit on other people's names. It's really something. Yeah. Some kind of phenomenon.
That's why I hate looking like, you know, people write about shows and whatnot. Like, you know, whenever like teams plays or something, you know, like Brooklyn Beat, you know, like do like some write up about it. And I always hate, like, I never look at comments or if there's an interview. You know, like Brooklyn Vegan should not put, they should deactivate those fucking comments, I think, man. It's just like, it just gives people like a forum where they can have a soapbox and just be shitty, you know, and that sucks. I think that it's like, nowadays everyone has a voice, but it's like, some people shouldn't have a fucking voice. Like if you define, you know, they're just looking to assert themselves, but they have nothing really to say. And they shouldn't have the opportunity to do that if you know what I mean, you say. You know. You know, there's like this populist idea of the internet being this like ultimate populist, you know, forum. But it's like, you know what? If you have something to say, absolutely. But if you have garbage that comes out of your mouth and like garbage thoughts and like no fucking point, then you really shouldn't have the privilege to fucking put that energy out there. You know? I don't know. It just it gets, you know. But on the other hand, sometimes there are a lot of, you know, like the positive end of that is that there is sort of this like bullshit detector when there is someone who's trying to put false information out there. A lot of times people will call that person out.
It's funny because, like, you know, Jack Kirby, like, his philosophy was truth will out. The truth will out. People will get credit. And he, like, strongly believed that. It was almost naive. And, of course, it's not true. Like, he thought that no matter how Marvel would try to victimize him and take away his creations and give fucking way more credit to Stan Lee than he deserved, his name would rise. The truth is, it's kind of a neck and neck race, you know?
Yeah.
Stan Lee has his, the thing is with life is that everybody's got their own narrative. Stan Lee in his head is justified in what he does.
True. Yeah.
I'm justified in what I do. Even fucking shitty things that I do, there's a way that I kind of fucking live with myself. And everybody has that same fucking rationalization going on in their head. It's really, really fucking eye-opening. Nobody sees themselves as a villain, of course. Even villains and stories, if you fucking are an actor and you're playing a villain, you got to figure out a way that character sees themselves as the hero.
Well, that's the thing, man. It's like, you know, even though we all coexist in this continuum of, like, reality, you know, each individual, it's almost like this solipsistic trip where, mm-hmm. you know, reality to me is what I conjure up. Like, I construct my own reality, so I can convince myself that, like, oh yeah, you know, I'm right. Like, this is the way it is because, you know, my consciousness goes unchecked and creates this reality unless there's a communication from somebody, and then I have to, like, take their point of view in consideration. And that's kind of like the ego of Stan Lee and the ego of Jack Kirby probably prevented that communication from actually happening. Like, Stan Lee in his, you know, world was, you know, of course, you know, I wrote all these stories, you know, I created this, like, you know, continuum of the early, you know, this universe. And Stan Lee was like, Jack Kirby just draws the pictures, you know what I mean? And it's not viewed as, like, when I think of Captain America, I think of, like, Stan Lee. I think of Jack Kirby's rendition of him. I think of the Fantastic Four. I think of Jack Kirby, you know? I think of, you know, that's what comes to mind, you know? And I think the irony is that comic books is primarily, I mean, yes, writing is important, but it's visual, a heavy visual medium. You know, and for the writer to take, like, you know, like, so much liberty and be like, oh, you know, I fucking rule this shit. I think it's, like, very egotistical, and I love Stan Lee, but also, mm-hmm. you know, I see his flaws in him taking all the credit for all this stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's funny, the contrast between the two personalities, too. It's like, Stan Lee talks like a P.T. Barnum huckster.
Yeah.
Jack Kirby talks like Jackson Pollock. He's, like, so, you know, I read this, there's this one interview I read with him where he was like, you know, the thing exists before I draw it on the paper. I pull it down from the universe, like, really mystical and intense.
Yeah. But I think that's a common thing with creative people, though. It's like, you know, you think of, like, your imagination, you think of the imagery, or with me, it's more sound and, like, words and whatnot. But, you know, creative, like, there's obviously things influencing you, but ultimately something original comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where does that come from, you know? And of course, there is the idea that there all this, like, you're channeling into some other, like, as a creative person, you've modified your consciousness to be able to pick this data, to tune yourself to this continuum where it might even be your personal channel that you're pulling this information from, but you've modified your consciousness enough where, like, you can connect to that world and, like, pull these things out of that world and manifest themselves as either like a drawing or like a piece of art or music or, you know, writing or something like that. So, I mean, I find that to be common whenever people that are creative talk about how they create. You know, it's almost like there's a muse or something, and they pull these things fully formed, you know?
Yeah. Tom Hart used to say, like, especially with the Suspect Device style working, he's like, it's one more reminder that you have stories in you you didn't even know that were there. So I'll give that assignment to people or some other triggering assignment, and all of a sudden they're like, you know, yeah, so I got this story, and this guy's a mailman, and when he snaps his fingers, like, internal combustion engine is created or whatever, and it just comes out incredibly evolved. But, you know, apparently, I mean, yeah, we have it in us. Apparently, like, what's his name? Guy who, Campbell said that, like, the reason the hero's arc, the reason he designed the hero's journey arc that he talks about is because that's the way we dream. When I remember fragments of dreaming, there'll be parts where I'll remember fragments and it'll be like, yeah, there's a whole developed, evolved story where I was like in the third act and I was like, you know, trying to scramble to redeem myself while the clock was ticking.
Yeah.
And it's influence the other. It's like that influenced storytelling and movie making and comic book making, not the other way around necessarily.
Yeah, it's that's why, like, I was thinking about the you know, like, we were talking earlier about how there's all these, like, old cats who are going back to their fucking roots and, like, revisiting all this old material that they've written, you know, like Cro-Mags and making, you know, like, for nostalgia reasons. And to me, because of this whole continuum of creativity where, like, you connect to something, it just seems completely illogical to do that. You know, if you, like, the me of, like, 10, 15 years ago doing this process and the me now doing this process are two different things on the timeline. So when I think about, oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to, like, perform material I wrote, like, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it just seems like, like, I can't even fathom doing that, you know? I mean, for you, like, right, like, your drawing style, like, 15 years ago, where you were at as an artist,
and now,
it's like asking you to draw or create something or reference that somehow, and you can't seem to, you just can't.
No, I can't get why some creators who keep on just churning out the same stuff instead of sort of turning over the soil, like, on a regular basis, I'm not gonna, you know, I don't get that. And as an audience member, I might like their work, but, like, I'm like, I kind of know what to expect, so I don't even look at it. But you know, I mean, there are bands where I've seen the opposite happen every now and then. I remember seeing Greg Ginn tour on the mid-90s, and he was doing all of the material off of, like, the earliest Black Flag material, everything off the 6-pack, 7-inch. Wow. And he, my friend Steve, played bass for him. I met Steve, like, going to go see, like, every Greg Ginn show I could. He was like, he hates doing this material. He hates it. And that, somehow that energy, like, really was charging the songs. I mean, he did Depression, did 6-pack, and every fucking one of them was really, really, like, had this incredibly youthful, fresh energy. Like, he was, like, looked like he was going to fly apart singing these songs. I mean, I'm in a very small minority. Nobody else likes that fucking Greg Ginn mid-90s material, but I love Getting Even. I love Dick. Let It Burn. And he came out 3 albums at once. Unfortunately, like, I saw him in 99 before he did his, like, Black Flag reunion, and I don't know what happened. It was, like, completely flaccid.
Huh.
It was so bad. His singing was bad. His energy was bad. I don't know what the fuck happened. But, I mean, and even guys who are on his label. I remember going to the SST Superstore, and a guy who played in one of the bands who was on the label, who was always working there, was, like, mocking him, going, you know, oh, yeah, Greg, he's trying to fucking, you know, how does somebody smoke as much weed as him and still try to, would, you know, justify being so angry? Like, it was all a big put on. And I don't know. I don't know what it's like to smoke weed. I've never really fucking done it. So it seemed like those shows were fucking great. Those albums were great. And he seemed like he was in it for himself. And like, he was like really, I don't know, there's some things you can't fake. I remember talking to him because, like I said, I came to enough shows that I became like a regular. And it was, you know, to me, that was having a chance to see Greg Ginn, who, you know, was like such a big influence on me. It was massively huge, a huge opportunity. So I was going to see every show I could. I'd take the bus out in LA to go see them play. And I remember asking him once about tour, like something about playing the songs, and he said something about like how it doesn't even get real for him until he's on tour. Like, he talked about the music in a really organic way. He was like, you know, when I'm on tour, it builds up, and all the every night is like a continuum, you know, and it gets this big groove, and the other shit, it's like piddly shit to me.
That's interesting, because I can relate to that, because you know, like when you go on the road and you're playing, basically you're just, that's not creative. It's like an execution trip. You know, you're playing the songs where you rehearsed them. Mm-hmm. You've already written them. Everything's done. And you're just like recreating this material live for a live setting. You know, and the repetition, you know, it's almost like training something. You know, the repetition of every night doing that creates its own energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it develops the chemistry between the people playing. You know, I don't know if Greg Ginn feels chemistry with people in his band necessarily anymore, because, but, you know, for him, it's like this, you know, I imagine it's like possibly like this ritualistic thing of setting up your equipment, running through the set, you know, and sort of getting to that level and existing at that level and then going back into the world that you're in when you're not playing those songs. So, you know, but going through long periods of not playing material live, it's just like, you don't quite hit that same pinnacle you do unless you're like doing it every day.
Yeah.
So I could relate to that, you know. I remember, you know, I never met Greg Ginn, man. I remember in the mid 90s, I was living in Boston and he played a show at Tower Records in Harvard Square. And, well, I don't think Tower Records is there anymore.
I guess not.
Yeah, I remember there was a Tower Records in Harvard Square for a while. And I remember working and I was, you know, I remember he was playing that afternoon. And I was trying to get there for my job. I left a little early, and I got there just as they were done playing. And, like, Greg Ginn was like standing outside. And I was just like, "I want to talk to this guy, man." And like, I just never, you know. It's like, what do you say? You know.
I'm sure you can come up with something, but yeah, it was. I remember one time I said to him, I was trying to impress him because I like being a tour band and stuff. They took me out around to a couple of shows that were like outside LA. And I think one time I was talking about how many goofballs were in the audience. It was a bunch of like dumb little kids, you know. And I think I quoted Sick of It All. I was listening to Sick of It All's Scratch the Surface album and taking it really, really seriously. And I said something about, that one song, I think it's from some lyric from Step Down, and I quoted it verbatim. I'm like, you know, there's a bunch of people out there who are blah de blah, fashion trend, something, something, you know, and you just go, what are you talking about? Which is what I deserve, but yeah, as a kid.
I remember there was a venue in Long Beach, because for a while, wasn't there the SST office in Long Beach?
Yeah,
and there was a venue in Long Beach, and when I was on tour with Anabana, I remember, you know, we had the directions to the club, and I was looking at the directions, and it's like, well, you can't park in front of the club until after 5 or whatever, but if you get there early, it's, if you get there before 5, you can park at the SST parking lot, you know, they'll let you park the van back there. And I was like, I took it for granted. I said, gee, that was the address. And I looked at, like, this, you know, like, fucking record or something we had in the van, or tape, or, you know, whatever format we had. And it was fucking SST office. I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
So me and Josh, the bass player, we loaded in, and then we got there after 5, so we didn't park in their lot. We parked in front of the venue. And, I was just like creeping around there, like, is this fucking, you know, it's like a Sunday or something like that, so there, you know, there was no one there. And I'm like, wow, like, Greg Ginn hangs out here, man. I wonder, you know, wonder if he's around here or something like that. And I was talking to the promoter, the kid who ran, you know, did the show, and he was saying that Yeah, Greg Ginn has like donated almost 90% of the PA system they have there. It's all shit that he used to own.
Wow.
And he just was like,
whoa.
He said he drops by all the time and like he hangs out. Like Tchaikovsky comes by sometimes. And it was like, yeah, he's like giving us a bunch of shit just for free, you know. So like there's always like this, you hear about what a demon that guy is,
yeah.
And then like you hear stories like that. So
yeah, like Dave Markey, I read an interview with him, and he was just, I mean, you know, fucking Greg took what's that movie he did?
Reality 86.
The other one though, the Love Dolls movie.
Oh yeah, okay, right.
Demolition Love Dolls.
Yeah.
He like Greg, like after letting him have like a couple, like a few seconds of. Some SST song, might have even been a Black Flag song in the movie during a scene that had been there for 15 years. He fucking served him with a cease and desist. He had to re-edit the movie and he can't release it anymore. But yeah, it's like, you know, Ric Flair, read his book and he said if he had a problem with everybody who his friends had problems with, he would have been completely paralyzed. And he was like, you gotta treat people the way they treat you. And that's what he found in this business. He wrestled all kinds of people that he heard all kinds of shit about. He'd heard mad shit talked about, and he said that, you know, he couldn't, he had to deal with them how they dealt with him. Greg was cool to me. He fired my friend. My friend, like, things did not end up good with that lineup of Greg Ginn Band, but he was decent to me.
Damn. Yeah. Yeah, that's that reality. Did you see that one? It showed up online for like 2 days or something.
It'll be back. I'm sure it's back somewhere now.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? It was because I recently got this wonderful Mac TV. You know, so.
Oh, shit. What's that?
Yeah, it's like that little box there, but it allows you to, you know, watch stuff in iTunes.
Yeah.
You know, Hulu and. You can watch YouTube stuff like on a big screen.
Awesome.
So I remember watching Reality 86 somewhere, either on Vimeo or somewhere.
Yeah.
On that big screen there, and yeah, so it's around, but yeah, it's an interesting film. I wouldn't say it's like a great movie. It's
it's not fucking final word on, you know, what was important about. I mean, there's other bands just aren't that important.
Yeah.
And there's way too much footage of them. You know. The Black Flag's an important band, and then there's all this footage of Meat Puppets, and I think there's a little bit of the Minutemen, and then there's like Pain and Willie, and yeah. So, you know, did you read Joe Cole's book?
Yeah, Planet Joe.
I mean,
yeah.
I thought the whole movie was going to be like that. There's all this stuff where Joe was talking about how Markey would not stop filming, and there was one story you remember where Joe Cole and another dude were like. They were all, them and Dave Markey were tripping on acid and they started chasing around with knives like it was a Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And Dave Markey was going, why are you guys bad tripping me? But there was a lot of shit where, you know, stories where Rollins would, they'd be doing load in and he just turns the camera and just like start threatening him. Which, you know, it sounds like really entertaining.
Yeah.
I thought that shit would be in there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty legendary movie. I remember when it popped up online, I was like, I watched it. I'm like, this is going to exist for like another 3 hours and someone's going to fucking pull it down. And that's sure enough. I think it was live for like 2 days and then like it just disappeared, you know? And, it's like, someone once told me that you're never going to know the full Black Flag story until Greg Ginn's dead, basically. So, I don't know. I forgot who told me that.
Yeah.
Someone over the years.
Do you think is missing? I mean, everything's fucking been told, you know?
Well, I mean, it's been told, but it's been told, like, you know, that Rollins has his version of the band, of, like, what happened, and, you know? And then there's, like, little snippets that get revealed in, like, interviews or whatever with other people, like, you know, Keith Morris will talk about Black Flag a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, but there's not really, the guy who started the whole thing hasn't really put any words down about it necessarily. I mean, you'll catch pieces of him discussing it in like some of these like, you know, American hardcore or whatever, but it's never really, you know, or like that Decline of Western Civilization, like the early, very early years of Ron Reyes, there's like interviews with Greg and, there's like that, you know, segment with Chuck Tchaikovsky talking about, you know, whatever. But there isn't like a document of him, of Greg describing the SST Black Flag experience. And that would be the real story in some ways, because, or at least something true to what his vision could have been about it, instead of, you know, as much as I respect Henry Rollins and I love all of his output and his writing, he was only involved for like, you know, a half the time that the band was around here.
And how much did Pettibone have to do with it? I mean, my friend Eric Lyle did a scam zine, Iggy Scam. He's doing a Black Flag tribute issue of Scam right now, and he researched it really hard. And, you know, I introduced him to Pettibone, because Pettibone spends a lot of time in New York, and I've known Pettibone since 98, and he wanted to ask Pettibone a bunch of questions, but they kind of lost contact. And I saw him the other day, and I said, well, what did you want to ask him? And he said that he wanted to ask him, like, Black Flag's whole aesthetic was so much about noir, like old LA noir.
Yeah.
And how, like, quoting moments verbatim, because I was really fascinated by this, Iggy said, okay, so you've got this band who he saw as like holding up a mirror to LA, you know, you got this, like, doing reportage, you know, fucking city, run by pigs, you know, beating up all the kids and all this other shit, like, day in the life of LA. And then on top of it, you had Pettibone's artwork, which really imprinted it with this vision of dark, shadowy LA noir, complete with girls with 50s haircuts and guys with fucking, like, guys with old, outdated 1950s clothing. And the starkness of his artwork and everything, it all imprinted itself on the vision of the band. I mean, on the image of the band, not the vision. And he wanted to ask Pettibone how much of that was intentional to try to brand the band this way, as this kind of, like, noir like writing project. Art music writing. So I thought that was a great question, really cool.
Yeah, but he never got a chance to.
Maybe he still will, but I think he's going to print really soon. We were talking about, actually, I was going to try to get together Pettibone this week, but I haven't been able to get a hold of him.
So now, as far as the work that you have, is that available anywhere? Like, do you have a website, or the people,
Yeah.
Get copies of the work that you have out?
Yeah, I'll talk real briefly about what else I have. So I've had the best professional year of my life. And I mean, the last year and a half has been incredible. So I'm in a lot of anthologies that are coming out. Basically, it's a short version of the story. And I'm going to be in issue 2 of Henry and Glenn Forever and Ever. And I'm going to be I'm in a bunch of fucking anthologies. I just was in Secret Prison 7 from Philly. And then I have my own stuff. I'm doing a collaboration with my friend Pat Alessio, which is kind of going to be a sort of a fusion of RoboCop, Maniac Cop, Bad Lieutenant, and John Carpenter's The Thing, with a little bit of Taxi Driver mixed in.
Wow.
It's we're working on that right now. We think we're going to call it Last Rites. And it's about a future where there's these cops who are the stars of a reality television show about corrupt cops. And nobody cares. They do everything out in the open. People record it. They go on. They do all kinds of shit that I wouldn't even say on the air. Just really. So that's where we're starting it. And we're, like, just the beginning stages of that. But that the design, Pat's pretty ambitious and smart. And he went to me and said, let's do a graphic novel. We've done short collaborations. And he was like, let's do a 150-page book and get it printed and, you know, quit fucking around with half measures. So we're going full measure. So that's what's going on. I got my comic Raw Power that came out last year, which was like about partially about G. Gordon Liddy. And because the Dylan comic, I thought, because I kind of hold that era, that 1960s and 70s era, I hold it with a looser grip. I thought I did better work about it. If I tried to do something about Rollins or John Brandon or something I'm obsessed with, I don't know if I'd do as good of a job. So I did a book about Liddy. He's more also, it's good to do work about shit that was around you when you were a kid, I think. So I do. I have Nixon appears in my work a lot. A lot of shit which was surrounding me, kind of these emblems of male, of these male icons that I didn't really understand. I just knew Whitney was supposed to be a badass, and I think I understood at some point that he ate a rat and that he'd mutilate himself. So he's in
it's
it.
Like Gigi Allen or something.
He's totally like Gigi, yeah. So in fact, in the book, he's got the same initial, G. Gordon.
Oh, jeez.
So I actually call him G.G. Whitney throughout the book.
Whoa.
And in my comic, the real money shot is he's in prison and he carves a huge F into his chest because he says it stands for fatherland, because that's what he values the most. So it's a fictionalized version. Like, his book in my comic is called Wish Power instead of Willpower. So I'm doing a sequel to that right now, and I have a script in my back. I'm just putting notes down in the script, and as soon as I got the full 50 pages done, I'll release that. I got Raw Power. I got ROM, which is my sort of riff off of ROM Space Knight. And I got a bunch of other little short anthology pieces I've been doing. Me and Pat Alessio and Keenan Keller just did a book, a riff off of Marvel Comics, like a kind of unauthorized Marvel Comics comic,
yeah.
Where I did like ROM, Deathlok, Moondragon, U.S. Agent, Howard the Duck, and I think that's everybody all hanging out in a strip club. And then like Plastic Man comes out from a portal, like a spoon tube, and he's like, "You guys are partying now, but I need to warn you, the good times aren't going to go on forever, because everybody on that list was made by a creator, except for Deathlok, was made by a creator whose life was tragically cut short." And everybody's like, "What are you talking about? You know, we're snorting coke and fucking getting lap dances." And he goes down the list. He's like, USA, oh, Mastodon from DP7 is in there too.
Oh, wow.
He's like, US Agent, Mastodon, created by Mark Gruenwald, dies of a heart attack at age of like 53. Howard the Tuck, invented by Steve Gerber, you know, dies, basically he's pushing it because he lived a pretty full life, but he died too young, 60s. Living Zombie and Moondragon were both created by Bill Everett, dies of alcoholism in the 1970s. And Bill Manilow was ROM's basic creator, and he, you know, he's, for those of you who don't know, the great writer Bill Manilow was hit by a car in 92 and has been forced to live in getting 24-hour-a-day care for the last 20 years.
I had no idea about that.
You didn't know that?
No, man.
He was hit by a hit-and-run driver. He had quit Marvel Comics and gone on to be he went back to law school and had just gotten started as a law career. And he was the age we are now. He was like 41, 42.
Something like that.
Wow. Cool. So he's rollerblading and somebody hits him. His head goes right into the window shield and the car keeps going. And he can kind of talk, but he's really, really, really impaired.
Wow.
So I've always found it to be really amazing how much when you read those issues of ROM, where ROM is always he's painfully aware that he used to have a better quality of life, and now he's sort of clinging to little shreds of what his life used to be. He's got like little bits of flesh that are still inside, buried deep in that silver suit.
Yeah. It's interesting because I used to read, when I was a kid, I remember when ROM came out, and I have the entire series. And it's like such an obscure character in Marvel Comics to focus on. I find that just interesting that you grabbed onto the ROM character. Because even younger readers like of comics, like people I talk to, like,
yeah.
There's only maybe one or two other people that when I mentioned ROM Space Knight, that they knew who the fuck I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know Mike Scandato?
No.
Him and his brother are on Brooklyn Monster.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, sure. Yeah,
Mike's been on the podcast a couple times.
Was he an Inhuman?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, Inhuman and, you know, The Last Stand. He's a great friend of mine. He's been on the podcast a couple times, and he knows who ROM is only because he's, like, the fact and figure man for everything related to comics and, you know, hardcore metal and horror movies and giallo and stuff like that. So he's, like, like the Rain Man of like all that shit, so he knows all that stuff. But I talked to like other people who are into comics, and a lot of people don't even fucking know about them.
I think there's a big, even though it's in small numbers, I think the intensity is growing. I think a lot of people discovered ROM, and there was a big tribute from Floating World Comics in I think it's in Seattle, and they did a tribute called Space Night, N-I-G-H-T, which is to raise money for Bill Manuel.
Oh, wow.
And they had a bunch of different creators. If you Google it, you'll find these amazing illustrators doing these beautiful pictures of Rom, like everybody redesigning him. The only person I really knew who was on the list was Benjamin Mara. And he did a really funny picture of Rom. He's like, I guess he hadn't really read it. So Rom's, you know, he's got, Rom has this neutralizer which zaps aliens back into portals, which takes them to like a sort of negative zone like dimension. And he, I don't think he read them that carefully. So he had Rom like hitting, the blasting these aliens and their entrails are flying out of their bodies.
Yeah.
And then I read the version of Rom, which where he guest stars in Power Man and Iron Fist, and that artist did the same thing.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of like, I don't think he got, you know, sometimes that happens. These guys don't get the dossier on the character.
Yep.
So Rom's like blasting aliens and they're literally like disintegrating into like, and like getting blown away. But I asked Mara about it. I was like, oh, did you do a tribute to the Power Man Iron Fist version? And he was just, he didn't know what I meant.
Oh, wow. So all this stuff is like, you can, like, where can you get this stuff?
JoshBayer.com. B-A-Y. It's like Bear is like Slayer with a B. B-A-Y-E-R.
I'll put a link up on with the blog, the portion of this, like the text version. I'll have like links to all this stuff.
Then I also am going to be having a bunch of shit which appears in this magazine coming from Philly, done by Box Brown, my publisher, called Comics Are Dope. So I have to ask you some questions.
Yeah.
So sure. Just do it like tailored, just do it now and I can get a recording later and type it up.
Sure, man. Yeah, let's do it right after this, man.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll do it like, we'll shut this down and you can do it. And, you know, so it could be exclusive content for your thing.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, man. So that's awesome, dude. Anyway, thanks for coming by.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Going pretty deep on all this stuff.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome, man.
I thought so, too.
All right, thanks.